We are in week 4 of 7 weeks. And until this point, we have essentially been laying groundwork. We've actually spent the last 3 weeks really sort of responding to a common claim that the difference between folks of different genders in terms of who can lead, who can count in a minion, has to do with obligation in davening. And we spent the first week seeing that, in fact, there is no difference in obligation to daven between women and men. And then we spent the second and third weeks saying, showing that even if one thinks there is, that not only is there no difference between women and men with regard to obligation to daven, but also this idea of davening with a community, davening with a minion, it's unclear that there is such an obligation. And to the extent that such an obligation exists, there's no reason to think it is gendered. Either that obligation has to do with improving your prayer experience, in which case anyone who's obligated to pray should be obligated to pray with a minion, or that obligation has to do with making sure that a minion exists, in which case whoever counts in a minion is obligated to go to a minion, and we can't determine that until we look at, well, who actually counts in a minion. So for the remaining 3 weeks, 4 weeks that we have, this week we'll be looking at the question of Torah reading. What does it mean to read Torah for the community? Who may do that? Next week, we'll look at leading davening, the question of what is the prayer leaders doing when they're leading davening in general? Who may do that? And then we'll spend the final 2 weeks looking at the question of who counts in a minion and what does it mean to count in a minion? We're going to start with a source that actually says something that probably many of you already are taking for granted, but I want to name it explicitly, which is that the motivating idea behind all of our questions is that in order to lead something, right, we'll actually challenge this idea when we come to counting in a minion, the question of who, what does it take to count in a minion? With regard to leading something, there's a principle that in order to lead something for others, you must yourself be obligated in that thing. That idea comes from source number one here, Mishnah Rosh Hashanah 3:8. Zeh haklal, this is the rule. Kol she'enu mechuyav b'davar, enu motzias harabim b'idei chovasan. Anyone who's not obligated to do something cannot fulfill that obligation for others. So for example, I have a 6-year-old child. According to Jewish law, he is not obligated to make kiddush. And therefore, if he made kiddush at our house on Friday night, I would not be able to fulfill my obligation by saying amen to his kiddush. As opposed to my 12-year-old child, she's a girl. In our family, we follow the practice that adulthood for Jewish girls begins at age 12. And so if she were to make kiddush for our family, as she does every other month, she and her brother fight over that right every month. When she does that, I am able to fulfill my obligation by answering amen to her kiddush because she is obligated to make kiddush. And therefore, she can fulfill my obligation for me as well. That's the motivating principle. And so we'll talk next week about how that applies to leading davening. What is it that you are doing for others when you're leading davening? This week, we're going to focus on the question of Torah reading. And we'll have in our minds already this idea that, well, is there an obligation here to be fulfilled? And if so, who has that obligation? But we'll see right off the bat in sources 2 through 4 that's hard to understand the concept of Torah reading. So take a look at source number 2, which is specifically about Torah reading. Katan kore'u b'Torah u'mitargem. So a minor may read from the Torah and translate. The translation here is referring to a practice that outside of the Yemenite community we no longer have, which is that you would read the Torah verse by verse, and after each verse, you would read the Aramaic translation as well. And that has a sort of ritual weight as well, just like the Torah reading itself. Don't get too bogged down in that, but a minor may do that. Aval, eino pores al shma, ve'eino over lifnei ateva, ve'eino noseas kapav. However, a minor may not do this responsive shma thing that we don't do anymore, so we're going to put that to the side also. It's not relevant this week anyway, and even next week when we talk about leading, we'll talk about why it's not relevant next week. And they may not pass before the ark, meaning they may not lead davening, and they may not lift up their hands, meaning the priestly blessing. They don't do those things. So right off the bat, we see that a minor, who we know from our previous conversations, is not obligated. They're not chayiv in anything. Nonetheless, they may read Torah, according to the Mishnah. And so right off the bat, if we have this principle that anyone who's not obligated in something may not fulfill the obligations of others in that thing, well, that right away suggests to us that maybe Torah reading is not about an individual obligation. Because if it were, it would be hard to understand why a minor could, in fact, read Torah for the community. So that's our first clue that we're not going to be in the land of obligation talk today, but rather thinking about something else. So that's about a minor. And as we've seen in previous weeks, there are ways in which minors and women in classical ancient texts are equated, and there are ways in which they are not. So let's turn out sources 3 and 4. Which are not about a minor, but in fact about, well, not exclusively about a minor, but also about gender. And we will see, I will warn you right away that source number three is a very obscure. This is from Tosefta. It's a work that comes from the same time period, basically, as the Mishnah. So basically contemporaneous with source number two. But because for various reasons it wasn't as studied, it often has more obscure traditions. It's often harder for us to know what exactly it means. We'll see an example of that right away. Says the Tosefta source number three, Hakol olin leminyan shiva, all may go up for the count of seven, meaning the seven aliyahs that we read from the Torah on Shabbos morning. So anyone can take one of those seven aliyahs. Anyone may go up for those seven. I'm going to apologize in advance for the language here that which diminishes women. Afilu isha, afilu katan, even a woman, even a minor. That is to say, you might have thought, you might have had a havamina, something that you would have thought that maybe a woman is less likely to be able to read Torah for the community. So you might have thought that. But in fact, even a woman, even a man is allowed to read Torah. And then, perplexingly, a woman is not brought to read to the public. Now, this is perplexing because this seems to contradict itself, right? On the one hand, in lines one and two of the Hebrew, and basically of the English as well, we say that a woman is able to take an aliyah. And then in line three, we say, but a woman may not read publicly. I will, right off the bat, knock down a possible interpretation you might have imagined that would make sense of this. You might have thought, oh, what that means is women may take aliyahs, but they may not read. That is not, however, is not a possible interpretation of this Tosefta, because in the time of the Tosefta and the Talmud, there was not yet a distinction between the Torah reader and the person taking the aliyah. So nowadays, again, outside of the Yemenite community, in most synagogues, there's one person who's reading the Torah portion, and other people take the aliyot. But in the time of the Talmud, if you were called up, Lynn, you're the top person on my screen, so I'll usually use my example. If Lynn were called up to the Torah for the third aliyah, she would not just be saying the blessings before and after, but she would also be reading the Torah itself. So that distinction does not exist in the time period of the Tosefta and the Talmud. So that's not what this means. So how do we understand this idea that that women are able to take aliyahs, and on the other hand, that a woman should not be called to read to the public? There are many possible interpretations. We're not going to try to resolve this because the truth is we're going to see a version of this text that becomes more canonical, more authoritative in a moment. But you can imagine something like, well, maybe we cross the rabbim to read in public means something more public. Maybe there's a small community, large community divide. Or maybe there's a language of lechatchila bidi eved. That is to say, what you're supposed to do and what's okay if it happens, right? So maybe you're not supposed to call women to take aliyahs in shul. But if it happened, if someone called a woman by mistake, they didn't know, whatever, that would be okay. It would be valid. There are other possibilities here as well. But this text gets slightly transformed, slightly edited, when it appears in the Babylonian Talmud, in the Talmud that we always look to as the canonical Talmud. And that's source number four. Tanu Rabbanan, our rabbis taught, Hakol olin leminyan shiva, all may go up for the count of seven, Afilu katan, afilu isha, even a minor, even a woman. You can see right off the bat, this is clearly the same text that we just had in the Tosefta. It begins exactly the same, but the last two lines will be much clearer. Aval amru chachamim, however, even though that's true, that anyone, including women, including children, may take aliyahs, the sages stated, isha lo tikra b'torah mipnei kvod tzibur. The sages decreed that a woman should not read Torah because of the honor of the community, because of kvod hatzibur. I'm going to start using that phrase, kvod hatzibur, now without translating it, both for the sake of time and because it's an important phrase in everyone's ears. So I'm just going to say it one more time, kvod hatzibur, the honor of the community. So in this version of the text, source number four, it seems like what we're claiming is, and this may or may not be what source number three meant, for the sake of time, we're going to assume that it is. We're saying, yeah, there's a core law, a core principle that yes, your identity does not matter when it comes to reading Torah. Anyone may read Torah. Any Jew, at least, let's say, may read Torah. It's implied, though not stated, that they must be Jewish. But there was a later decree, this is not kvod hatzibur, to have women read Torah. We'll talk more a little bit about what does it mean to be kvod hatzibur or not. We'll talk quite a bit about that in a little bit. But for now, we can just simply say, there's this idea that in principle, this is okay. There's a later decree that somehow this is not, it's not covetic. It's not sufficiently honorable. So there are a couple of questions that come out of this, and we're going to take them one by one. The first question we want to think about is, why? right? In a world that's so heavily gendered, where so many things do seem to be distinguished between folks of different genders, why would you say that, and you can even leave aside the question of gender, right? Why would you even think that a minor could read Torah, right? We began this idea that if you're not obligated in some matter, you can't fulfill others' obligations in it. So how is it possible that a minor or a woman in this gendered world could read Torah? And we will look to the view of Rabbeinu Tam, the Tosfos here, trying to explain why that is. So we're on source number 5. The fact that a minor or an eved, a slave, or a woman, as always, you have to know the problematic nature of that triplet, but recognize that it's a common one in rabbinic literature. The fact that they can all go up, that is to say, take an aliyah and read Torah, the leis nehu b'talmud Torah, right? Even though they're not obligated in studying Torah, that is a topic for an entirely different 6-week-long or 6 or 7-week-long class. We're not going to get into it. We're going to take for granted that according to the classical rabbis, men are obligated to learn Torah and women aren't. Obviously deeply problematic, but we have to just sort of take that for granted for this particular course. Even though they're not obligated in learning Torah, the fact they go up the minyan shiva for the count of 7, why is that? Mishum desever Torah l'shmiyakai. Because a Torah scroll is meant to be heard, right? The point is not to fulfill some obligation, but rather just to hear the Torah read. That's why the Sefer Torah is, that's why the Torah scroll is brought out. Ubir kasan ein levatala. And the bracha that they make, we make blessings before and after each aliyah. Those blessings are not blessings in vain. Why? Delo mevarche asher kiddushanu b'mitzvoisa v'tzivanu al ha-Torah. Because when you go up to the Torah, you don't say a blessing that says, blessed are you God who has commanded us, who has sanctified us and commanded us regarding the Torah study. That's not what you say. Ella, asher bachar banu, v'asher nasan lanu. Right? Rather you say, blessed is God who chose us to receive the Torah, who gave us the Torah. And what this implies, as I've already alluded to, as I've already implied, is that Torah reading, unlike some other things that we do in Shul, is not a question of obligation. It is not that, I picked on Lynn before, so I'll go to Josh, who's second on my screen. It's not that Josh is obligated to hear the Torah in Shul every Monday, Thursday, Shabbos morning, and Shabbos afternoon, but rather that the community has to make sure that the Torah is heard. But there's no individual obligation, right? It's what we'll call a chovas hatzibor, a communal obligation. And therefore, there's no question of being obligated and fulfilling others' obligations. It's rather, I just need to make sure that someone from our community reads the Torah so that the Torah is heard. If that's the case, then there's no reason to think that Torah reading would be either gendered or age-dependent. It doesn't matter if you're obligated. And in fact, there are some communities still, again, very often around Torah reading, the Yemenite community is distinctive. And in the Yemenite community, there are still times when they will have minors read from the Torah publicly, because it's not a matter of obligation. And so even though a minor's not obligated, nonetheless, they can read Torah. So this is our conceptual model we'll be working with for the rest of today, this idea that Torah reading is not fundamentally about obligation. It's fundamentally about making sure that the Torah is heard. And whoever reads it, that's fine. We've already seen, we have this question of Kodat Tzibor. We'll come back to that later. But in principle, anyone, I'll say any Jew, because I think it's implied, can read the Torah publicly, and that will be valid. So we've dealt with the question of why would it be the case that even a minor and in a gendered world like the world of the Talmud, even a woman could read Torah? Is there any limitation? Leaving aside the question of Kodat Tzibor, is there any limitation on that? I'm going to show you 2 conflicting views. We have first the view of the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim, sources 6 and 7. This is the same person. I just brought 2. There's a slight difference between the two. Let's look at source number 7, which is the stricter of these 2 sources. Katan Kore B'Torah, a minor may read from the Torah. So he's commenting on that mission that we saw, source number 2. Lahashli Laminyan Shiva, right? What does it mean that a minor may read from the Torah? Says the Ran. Not that they may read in an unlimited way with no qualifications, rather only to complete the 7. Velo shiu kulam ketanim, velo rubam. But not that they should all be minors or even a majority. So says the Ran, even though a minor may read Torah in Shul on Shabbos morning, let's say, to keep it simple, only 3 out of the 7 aliyahs may be read by a minor. However, a majority of the aliyahs, 4, would have to be read by an adult. And if you're assuming, as the Mishnah, as the Baraisa, the Talmud passage we saw in source number 4 kind of implies that women and minors are equivalent for these purposes. Again, a terrible sentence to say, but operating in their discourse. If you assume that women and minors are equivalent for these purposes, then that would mean also that a woman could only read a minority. Right? They may only contribute to the seven, but they may not be entirely the seven. Now, why that would be is fairly unclear. In source number six, which I didn't read for the sake of time, he says, because they're not b'nei chiyuva, but that doesn't really make, right, which means that they're not obligated people, which doesn't fully make sense if you understand that to mean they're not obligated in Torah reading. Because they're not obligated in Torah reading, then why could they read even one Aliyah, right? They shouldn't be able to read even one. So probably what the Ran means is this idea that since they're not fully obligated, right? Since women are, according to classical texts, are not obligated in all of the mitzvahs, but only most of them, therefore, there's some way in which their sort of representation of the community is not complete. We'll talk a lot more about that idea in week seven, the final week of this course. So if that's confusing to you, don't worry about it for now. Hold on to that question, and we'll come back to it in week seven. For now, what I want to see is that there is this voice of the Ran, which we'll see as a minority view, that says, even leaving aside the question of kvod hatzibur, this question of the honor of the community, even leaving that aside, there are limitations on minors and women's participation in Torah reading, namely, they may only be a minority of the Torah reading, not the full extent. That's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin, which becomes the sort of dominant approach to this question of are there limitations on women's participation in Torah reading, leaving aside for the moment the question of kvod hatzibur, comes from the Maharam of Rottenberg, a medieval German authority. This is an amazing, just the situation of this tshuva, this responsive is amazing. He says like this, source number eight. Ir shekula kohanim, ve'ein ba'afil Yisrael achad. You've got a city. Imagine a small Jewish community in medieval Europe where you only have maybe two or three large extended families. And they're all kohanim, they're all priests. Not a single non-Kohen among them. This might sound far-fetched, but I actually grew up in a small Jewish community. It wasn't quite this extreme, but there are basically two families that were the majority of the Jewish community, the Liedermans and the Nadlers, right? And if you weren't a Liederman or a Nadler, you know, so if the Liedermans and the Nadlers had both been Kahanim, you could imagine a world where there's no Yisrael. And in general, there's a principle that if you call a Kohen for the first Aliyah, which you're supposed to do, but there's no Levi, let's say, you call the Kohen for the first two Aliyahs. Because if you call the Kohen for the first Aliyah and then some random person for the second Aliyah, people might think, oh, the Kohen who was called for the first Aliyah was an invalid Kohen. That's why they didn't call a Levi second. So in general, the idea is you don't want to embarrass the Kohanim by calling the wrong order. So you either call Kohen, Levi, and then Yisrael is for the rest. Or if you don't have a Levi, Kohen, the same Kohen for the second Aliyah, and then Yisrael is for the rest. But in this town, we don't have any Yisraels. They're all Kohanim. So what are we going to do? Says the Maharam, Nireli, the Kohen Koreh Pamayim. You call one Kohen, and he reads the first two Aliyahs, just like I said, in the case where you have a Kohen, but no Levi, and you do have Yisraels. So that's fine. But now we don't have any more Yisraels. We don't have any Yisraels. So we can call for Aliyot 3 through 7, says the Maharam. Veshuv yikru'u nashim. And after that, have women read the rest of the Aliyahs. Why? Da'kol mashlimin l'minyan shiva. Afilu ev v'shivcha v'chatan. Because anyone can complete the count of the seven, even an eved, even a female slave, even a minor, and clearly by implication here, even a woman. Upeiresh Rabbeinu Simcha Zatzal, and this very important earlier Ashkenazi rabbi Rabbeinu Simcha comes along and says, the lav davka l'minyan shiva elafilu l'shlosh. Not only when you have seven aliyahs can you call up a woman for some minority, like the Ran said. But even on a weekday, when you only have three Aliyahs, you can call women towards that as well. Ditnan Stama, Beferek Shlishi Megillah, because the Mishnah that we saw in source number two said plainly, without any qualifications, Katan Kora Mitargem. A minor may read and translate. It didn't say a minor may read and translate a minority of the Aliyahs. It said a minor may read and translate in general, implying even all of the Aliyahs. And so therefore, in this community where you only have Kahanim, what do? Says the Maharam. In practice, there's an actual question that comes up for him. You call a Kohen for the first two Aliyahs, and then you would call up women for Aliyot 3 through 7. V'nei demezigala aval ruach hachamim lo tikra isha v'torah mibeik fo tzibor. Granted that the Talmudic passage, the Baraisa, that talked about women specifically, did have this rider, and even though in principle women can count towards the seven Aliyahs, we don't do that because of this thing called kvod tzibor. Even though that's the case, Yidach HaKfod HaTzibur may become Kohan it says that Korban should be a Kruyan, right? Where it's not possible to avoid calling women to the Torah, then Kfod HaTzibur is pushed to the side, because otherwise you'll embarrass the Kohanim. Shelo Yomru B'nei Grushos Hem. That we shouldn't say that these Kohanim are invalid Kohanim for some reason. So the Maharam says two things that are important. One is that in practice, he's willing to let this quoted Tzibur thing, which we're going to talk about shortly, get pushed aside. That's an important thing to remember when we get into quoted Tzibur in a little bit. But also, unlike the Ran, there's no limitation, right? Leaving aside the question of quoted Tzibur for the moment, women and minors, and he adds in Avadim, may all read from the Torah, take aliyahs without limitation. Okay.
It's not actually a question, it's more of an observation. We had already a source where we saw that there's a communal obligation to have a minyan as opposed to an individual obligation to go to a minyan. And now it seems that the parallel is there's a communal obligation to hear the Torah read rather than an individual obligation to read it.
Excellent. Is that the whole of the observation, Rhonda?
Yes.
Perfect. And that is exactly right. And I will add that next week we talk about leading davening and talk about things like Kaddish and Kedusha and Barachu. We'll have the same language come up again there as well. So there's this whole category of things like having a minyan, like reading Torah, that are communal obligations. I actually didn't bring these commentators that actually say it explicitly for the sake of time. But you see this, for example, in the Ramban, in Nachmanides, this language of Chovas HaTzibur, an obligation on the community, meaning on all the people in this room, but it's not an obligation on Rhonda and Lynn and Josh individually. So that's exactly right. Okay, so what we've seen until now is that in principle, I'm going to leave aside minors for now because that's not our topic. In principle, women may read from the Torah, may take aliyahs. It's fully valid. There is this rider that they shouldn't do so because of Kfod HaTzibur. And there is some internal debate about whether, leaving aside the question of Kfod HaTzibur, whether that permission, that validation of women reading Torah is unlimited, like the Maharam says, or whether it is limited to a minority of the aliyahs, like the Ran says. I'll share my screen again. We're not going to do the next source inside for the sake of time, but I'll tell you what it says. You can take a look at it on your own. Rav Avadya Yosef, probably the most important 20th century Sephardi authority, he rules explicitly that in a situation where you don't have a choice for some reason, you can rely on this. And he points out that the Ran is basically the minority view, the view, not only the Maharam, but of others, is the dominant view that, in fact, controlling for Kfod HaTzibur, leaving that to the side, fundamentally, there is no limitation. As, you know, I think the Maharam makes a very good point. If the Mishnah wanted to tell us that a minor, and by extension, a woman, could read only a minority of the aliyahs in the Torah, well, then the Mishnah should have said that. It didn't. And so that probably means that, in fact, there is no limitation on that. Okay. The next page, sources 10 through 13, are all examples from classical Talmudic texts of this thing called Kfod HaTzibur. And the reason they're here, they don't have anything to do explicitly with gender and Torah reading, but they're here for us to get a sense of, well, what does it mean to say that something is a violation of Kfod HaTzibur? Why would they be forbidden because of Kfod HaTzibur? So take a look at source number 11, just by way of example. This is talking about what would happen in the temple on Yom Kippur, right? The rituals in Yom Kippur, which would include reading various passages from the Torah. And it says in the Talmud Yoma, it says, that when they would go to read the passage about Yom Kippur in the book of Numbers, the high priest would read it from memory. He would not read it from the scroll, which is how we always read Torah. This was one exception where the high priest would read that passage from memory. Why? Amai, why, says the Talmud? Niglo v'nikri. Just roll the Torah from Leviticus where you were, roll it to the book of Numbers, and then read from the Torah scroll and not read from memory, which that's always our strong, strong preference. Amar Rav Huna Breda Rav Yeshua, Amar Rav Sheshes. So Rav Sheshet comes along and says, Lefisha Ein Golalin Sefer Torah B'tzibur Mipnei Kvod Tzibur. Why did the high priest read the passage about Yom Kippur from the book of Numbers from memory and not read it from the Torah scroll? Because we do not roll a Sefer Torah publicly because of Kfod HaTzibur, because of the honor of the community. And there are actually two possibilities here, but I'm going to go with just one for now. We can come back to the other one later. It would seem like what we're saying is, why would I not want to roll the Torah scroll in front of the community? Well, because what I'm sure most, if not all of you have been in this situation before, right? What happens when the Gabaim, let's say, forgot to roll the Torah scroll to the right spot? Well, it's annoying, right? You're sitting there waiting for them to roll from, you know, they forgot to roll it from the book of Deuteronomy back to the book of Genesis. Now you have to wait around. And if you're lucky, they'll sing a nice nigun while you're waiting. But that's not nice. If you really respect your community, you're going to make sure that everything's ready to go. Is there somehow a violation of the honor? You wouldn't make, you know, if a VIP were coming to visit, you wouldn't make them wait while you get everything ready. You want to make sure that everything's ready to go when they get there. And so this idea of put a tzibor, you have four or five different examples here on this page, but it seems to be fundamentally about, in some way, the community is dishonored when we do something that is a violation of code at tzibor. Questions or comments on that?
I'd always learned it as terchel at tzibor, not kavod at tzibor.
Great. So terchel at tzibor is a concept that does come up in other places. And colloquially, we'll often talk about that with regard to rolling the Sefer Torah. But I don't know if it's ironic at all or not. It actually might actually be perfectly appropriate. When the Talmud talks about rolling the Torah, the reason it says that is because of honor the community. Now, they're related, right? The more I'm willing to burden, so we're on the same page, means a burden on the community. If I'm burdening the community, that's also a way of not showing them proper respect. So that could also be a part of what's going on here. But there are other things, you know, like if you're at a weekday minyan in a working community where folks have to get to their jobs and someone decides to sing every part of davening, that would be tirchei tzibura. Would also be a violation of kvod tzibur? Maybe. But that's you can see they're related, but not exactly the same.
Unfortunately, I was going to ask about how tirchei on the tzibur and kvod tzibur were related. So it's no longer applicable. But I'll share a one sentence thing that my uncle is a rabbi who's far to the right. And when we did a personal family Rosh Hashanah and we had to roll the Torah scroll in public, I said to him, if you're going to do this, I might as well come up and lean. And he thought that was very funny, but I thought that it was very real.
Yeah. I mean, I was trying to decide whether I was going to say something to that effect myself right now tomorrow. So I'm glad you did, so I didn't have to. I will say, I mean, again, I'm trying to use this course in a way because I know some of you want to be convinced. I know some of you already are convinced. I just want to know the sources. And some of you don't want to be convinced and just want to know what the sources say. I'm trying to do it in a way so I respect all of you in this room. But I will take one moment to be polemical and say I very much agree with what Tamara was saying, which is that there are communities where if a woman read Torah, that would be a total violation. Oh, now this place has gone to hell. We're not halakhic anymore, blah, blah, blah. But when they forget to roll the Torah in the right place, that's just something that happens, right? And it drives me crazy. End of polemic. I'll go back to being respectful of all of you in the room. I apologize for those I offended.
Yes. I mean, as far as rolling the Torah in public, I would, I don't know where else this might happen, but perhaps making a distinction between doing so because you weren't prepared and because you were doing so purposefully, as for Simchat Torah, Rabbi Steve Sager, of blessed memory, had long had this custom of when we did the final reading, we would then do a backward rolling where the kids and others gathered and he would narrate it. And then we would read again from Bereshit. And our current rabbi, Daniel Graber, has kept up that custom. But that's obviously an exception.
Yeah. One, and I think it's actually an important thing because it's not merely an exception. It's actually getting to the heart of the question of, well, what is kvod tzibur, right? And what we haven't talked about yet is, why would it be a violation of kvod tzibur for women to read? Right? What does that mean to say that it's a violation of the community's honor for a woman to read Torah? And there are many different attempts to try to explain what that would be. You can imagine, for example, saying in a world where men get education and women don't, if a woman reads Torah, it might be implying that the men in that community are not sufficiently educated. Maybe there isn't a man who's able to read the Torah, and that's embarrassing to them to have a woman read for them. You might say in a world where women are second-class citizens, it's embarrassing to have a woman represent you before God. Right? There are different ways you can understand this. But I want to say seriously, not just kvod tzibur as a sort of abstract halakha concept, but actually is reflecting something about what does it mean for our communities to have honor? And what does it mean for our community's honor to be violated? And in what way are we willing or not willing to say that having women read Torah is even in principle, let alone in practice, a violation of our community's honor? That's really important thing to take into account, right? When you're rolling it on Simchas Torah to make a point, to make a ritual out of it, no one's offended. Because everyone knows, this is what we as a community want. We'll get much more into this in just a little bit.
Yeah, just to clarification. So it's not just women, but anybody else in that category, minors, and so forth.
So, intriguingly, actually, it only gets applied to women, right? As far as we know, the rabbis of the Talmud never said that a minor may not read based on quoted tzibor, which is why I assume, actually, I don't know for sure, but I assume this is the reasoning why in Yemeni communities, even today, you will sometimes see minors reading from the Torah, but I have never heard of a woman reading is this true? I don't know. I don't know if there are any egalitarian Yemenite minyanim out there. There may be that I don't know about. But in terms of Yemenite minyanim, they're not actively trying to be egalitarian. You'll never see a woman read Torah there, but you will sometimes see minors read Torah there. So it in a way that for many of us is like deeply disturbing, it actually only limits out women and not minors. Now, I will say everywhere outside of the Yemenite community, this practice of minors reading Torah has basically been eliminated. So in that sense, it's been equated. But in terms of the sources, no, it only applies to women. Okay, let's continue on. And now we're going to see some sort of practical manifestations of this quota tzibor issue. Okay, so we're now on source number 14. This is a 13th to 14th century Provençal authority. So this is not some recent development. This is, 700 years ago. Says the Sefer Abatim, Yesh min hagadolim shekasav, shehamispalim bevateihem biasara. So one of the great authorities wrote that when people are praying with a minyan in their home, not in the synagogue, Isha Korah Shem B'Torah. In such a scenario, a woman may read Torah. Shaloni krat tzibor elek shemispalim bevesa knesses. Because it's only considered a tzibor, a community, when you're praying in synagogue. So right away you can imagine, in synagogue, it's more formal, it's different families, folks with different values potentially coming together, and there's some sort of overarching sense of, in some way, this community might be offended by a woman reading Torah. But when you're reading in a house minyan, well, then maybe, actually, Tamar, you're talking about your uncle's minyan. I assume that was in a house and not a synagogue as well, right? So Sefer Abatim would say, yeah, actually, aside from the fact that you rolled a Sefer Torah, also you're in a house, and this would actually be totally fine. Along the same lines, but even more clearly, Rav Yaakov Emden, a very important, I think he's 1700s, right? Whenever Shabtai Tzvi was. When was Shabtai? Was 1700s? Yes. Or 1600s. Someone will look it up and tell us in the chat. Rav Yaakov Emden writes like this. It seems to me that when you have people praying in the house of a new mother and her husband is not there, yesh lahamida davar al adin. In such a case, you can go back to the original principled halacha, not the one that was later decreed by the sages because of quoted tzibor. What's that? She'isha olah v'korah b'torah k'hai gavna, that a woman may go up and take an aliyah and read Torah in such a scenario. So the same idea, you're in a home minyan, not in a synagogue. Afal gav she'amru chachamim lo tikra b'tzibor m'nei akavod. Even though they said a woman should not read because of honor, lo amru ela v'kal rav. That only applies in a large congregation. V'shalo lasos tadir, and not to do regularly. Aval b'hai gavna. Right, but here, where it's not a regular occurrence and it's for her sake, the idea here seems to be that she's gonna, that she'll get the blessings like a Misha Berach for a new parent. And since her husband's not there to take the aliyah, well, who are you gonna give it to? You'll give it to her, to the mother herself. I can't believe I just said it that way, right? I mean, that's again, assuming this highly patriarchal model where the father would be the one to get the Misha Berach, not the mother. To me, it actually should make more sense that the mother get it in the first place, but. That's obviously not the world they're living in. In such a case, one could say that they never made a decree at all. Right? There's no quoted tzibor in such a case. And they said explicitly that anyone, they mean any Jew, they said anyone can take one of the aliyahs. Being lo achshav emasai, in a great use of Hillel. If not now, when? Right? That law has to apply somewhere. Emasai ela dvarim, evohem amurim. What was this line in the Talmud said for, if not for a moment like this one? Everything that's in the Talmud has to have a situation in which it applies. We would never say something just for the sake of theory, right? This is not the University of Chicago when they say, that works fine in practice, but how does it work in theory? No, everything must work in practice. kediavadam. In such a case, it's like a post facto case. And that's how I hold if others will agree with me. Rabbi Yaakov Emden does this actually a bunch, where he'll say something pretty radical for his time, and they'll say, I'm only saying this if other people, sometimes he even says, if three more rabbis will agree with me, then this is the halacha. But if no one agrees with me, then ignore what I'm saying. So Rabbi Yaakov Emden, like the Sefer HaBatim in the previous source, says, yes, in fact, in practice, when you are in a situation where there's not a quota tzibur issue, this is not a large community, because it's clear what's going on to everyone. This is not the standard practice. In those cases, it's totally fine, totally acceptable for a woman to read Torah. Now, that does not get us to the existence of modern-day egalitarian or partnership minyanim, where women read Torah every week, and that is in fact the practice, and where it is taking place in effectively a synagogue, or sometimes not even effectively, but actually a synagogue. But it highlights for us that this notion of quoted tzibur, this notion of the honor of the community, is contextual. It is not a sort of abstract principle that applies irrespective of who is in the room, but rather that we're looking at the scenario and saying, is this a situation in which people are going to be offended?
This concept of a community is not a community unless it's a synagogue. How common is in early modern halacha?
Right. It is, to my knowledge, is not a common reading, and I would say it's not a very good reading literarily of the phrase quoted tzibur. Because I don't think tzibur really means synagogue. I think tzibur means a minion. So I actually don't think it's a great reading of the text, but I think it's a great reading. Oh, let me rephrase that. It's not a great reading of the words of the text, but I think it's a very strong reading of the meaning of the text, by which I mean the idea that it's contextual, right? Not that it applies in synagogue, but it doesn't apply in your home, but that it doesn't always apply. It doesn't apply when it's clear to folks in the room what's going on. That I think is a strong reading, but it's not a common reading. And I think it's not only not common, but I think it's not a strong reading of the words.
I was kind of curious about why they are having, this might be, you know, a conversation for another time about, but why are they having a minyan in this woman's house? Ostensibly, they're having it, you know, so that she and her husband, or like that her husband can daven, but her husband's not there. So is the implication, I know that that's not a common practice today, is the implication that the new mother herself would have been the one getting the Misha Berach? You know, why is that happening?
So it's been a while since I've looked at that Rabbi Yaakov Emden in its entirety, but I believe I'm remembering correctly. So I'm going to say what I think it is, and then I'll check before next week, and I'll confirm this next week, God willing. If I remember correctly, the situation is a husband is out of town, which you can imagine happening. I mean, happens even now, but certainly in medieval times it happened more often. She is a recent mother. She just gave birth. She's not going to be able to go to synagogue, right? It's too difficult for her to get there. And so they're making a synagogue in her home. Normally, the father would get the Misha Berach or whatever blessing they would be making, but he's out of town, so they're going to give it to her. I think that's the context, if I remember correctly.
So I think that that's like especially interesting, especially given in light of the sources that we've seen earlier, because the implication is that this new mother, notwithstanding the fact that she has a newborn that she's taking care of, would still want to participate in davening with a tzibur. So that, yeah, I think is just a fascinating part of this.
And I should correct myself, I said medieval, but Rabbi Yaakov Emden would have about sort of early modernity already. So we're even in a later period where I think it's actually more surprising than it would have been in the medieval period. So I agree with you, Tamar.
So how do we apply this today when we have a trillion shtiblach and, you know, homes that have regular minyanim? You know, does this now apply, or is that now a bit Knesset?
Great. I'll offer you two readings, a narrow one and a broad one. I think the broad one is the stronger reading, but I'll offer them both. A narrow reading would say, well, we have laws about when a room becomes a Beit Knesset. And so even if it's in your basement, if you like have formalized it in the ways that would give it the law, the din of a shul, then it's a shul. But if you're just like, you know, we have minyan in our house sometimes, there's no question it's not a shul. We don't meet any of the halakhic standards for that. So there you could be lenient and call folks to the Torah irrespective of gender. But if it's like actually a formal synagogue, even if it's technically in your house, it wouldn't apply there. That's the narrow reading. I think that's the weaker reading. The broader reading would say, don't get hung up on synagogue versus home. The point is, what do people think when they look at this room? Do they feel like their honor is being violated? In a medieval or early modern synagogue, they might feel their honor is being violated where a woman reads Torah, again, for whatever reason, right? For whatever contextual, historical reason. But if you're in a situation where that's not the case, as for example, in my synagogue, right? Even though it's a synagogue, no one would be on would be offended. We'll say this more strongly later, but no one would be offended by a woman reading Torah. So that the whole point that the Kvotibor concern is a contextual concern, not an absolute one.
Well, so in thinking about this, the home synagogue versus the actual building, it seems to me we're talking about a situation where there are plenty of resources to do things right from the start. Doing things right means having more than one Sefer Torah, rolling them in place, having the right people leading and reading Torah versus an informal, last minute, don't have all the resources kind of place where you can't have more than one Sefer Torah, so you're going to have to roll it. And you don't have enough people to read Torah, so it's we're going to allow other people. I don't know why the Kvod HaTzibur seems to me, for Kvod HaTzibur, you have to plan, you have to do the right thing in advance.
Yeah.
Why women reading Torah is not the right thing in advance, you know, might be the question, but it's not unusual for me to think of that in that time. But the other thing I'm thinking about is that in this alternative space that's not a tzibur space and they're reading Torah, we haven't yet, it seems to me, seen that we need a minyan of men, women, or a minyan at all in order to read Torah. I haven't seen that come up. And it's interesting to me because from last week we learned that you don't need to daven. It's not, you're not obligated to daven in a minyan. You are obligated to make sure there is a minyan for the tzibur. But I don't know that the
great.
One of the reasons is in order to have Torah read.
Great. So we are not yet talking about, do you need a minyan? And if so, who counts in that minyan? We will see the source that gives us that already next week, but we won't focus on that piece of it. And then the 2 weeks after Thanksgiving is when we'll get into this question of, for what do I need a minyan? And who counts in that minyan? So that thing, Rita, it does exist. We just haven't seen it yet because of the way I organized the material. You'll see it next week. We'll focus on it for weeks 6 and 7. Okay. Let's jump back into the source sheet. The next source that we're not going to do inside for the sake of time, but I want to draw your attention to it. It's a really fascinating source also, similar to the Rav Yaakov Emden source that we just saw. This is a 20th century Israeli responsum, but early, like 1950s, if I remember correctly, maybe even earlier. I don't remember exactly. And what he says, the same idea, but the case is also fascinating, same with the new mother cases, which is in a case where you're having a family minyan, and you have a family where the real head of that family is a matriarch, right? Think about if, you know, I mean, I'm not expert in like the wealthy families of the world. But, like, think about a family where like Estee Lauder, right? I don't think she's alive anymore, but Estee Lauder, I assume, is like the matriarch of the Lauder family. If they're having a minyan in their house, well, who's the most honorable person in that room? It's not the men, it's the matriarch of the family. And so Ben Zion Abba Shaul of Or Letzion says, in such a scenario, it's not a violation of Kvodat Tzibur to have the matriarch take an aliyah. To the contrary, if the you know, most respected, in this case, wealthiest member of the family is the matriarch, well, then she actually would indeed get an aliyah. So we're not going to do that inside. I encourage you to read it on your own. It's a really fascinating take. We're going to turn now, though, to the core argument about Kvodat Tzibur. So this is 17, 18, and 19. And in these sources, Two late medieval, early modern authorities, Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, and Rav Yoel Sirkis, the author of the Bais Chadash, the Bach, disagree about the relevance of Kvodat Tzibur. So we'll take a look at source number 17 to get the Rav Yosef Karo, the Bais Yosef's opinion. He says, "V'chein kasav Rambam." Don't worry about what the Rambam actually said. I left it up for the sake of time. "Umi shelo nizmale zekano," someone whose beard is not filled out, right? So someone who, they're halakhically an adult male, but they don't yet have a full beard. Afa pishu chacham gadol, even though that 18-year-old might be the biggest Torah scholar in the room, lo yehe shaliach tzibur, mibnei kvodat tzibur. If you have a 20-year-old who's a huge Torah scholar, but they don't yet have a full beard because they're only 20 or 16 or whatever it is. I don't remember when my beard got full enough. Whatever it may be, they may not be the full-time cantor. They may not be the full-time chazan, right? Dot, dot, dot. Says Rav Yosef Karo, "Ulefi zeh, im ratzu hatzibur limchol al kvodam, nira sherishus biyadam." If the community wanted to waive their honor, to to be mochel their honor, to be mochel their kavod, they could have the right, right? I could say, you know what? I'm willing to be insulted in this moment. I'm willing to waive my honor and say, I'd rather have that 18-year-old who doesn't have a full beard but has a gorgeous voice. I'd rather have them lead davening than have the 45-year-old with a full beard but the kind of mediocre voice lead davening. So says Rabbi Yosef Karo, the sort of a community may choose to waive their honor, but he actually rules in his Shulchan Aruch, in his code of law, that in fact you may have someone who is not with a full beard lead davening for the community because a community can choose to waive their honor. That's the view of Rav Yosef Karo. If he says, and if we apply that to our topic, we would say if the community wanted to say, you know what, we're willing to be offended, we're willing to waive our honor. And you could even frame it, although I don't think this is being totally faithful to what Rav Yosef Karo meant, you can frame it as, we're not offended by that, right? Which to some extent you're not. If you're willing to waive your honor, what you're really saying is, I don't find that offensive. So if we're not offended by, or we're willing to waive our honor to have a mixed gender Torah reading, well then that power would be in the hand of the community to say. And that's effectively the argument of partnership minyanim, right? They rely on Rav Yosef Karo to say, the community can waive, or at least as far as I know, most partnership minyanim, they're relying on Rav Yosef Karo on the Shulchan Aruch to say, a community can waive their honor and choose not to be offended by women reading Torah. That's one side of this debate. The other side of this debate, source number 19, Rav Yoel Sirkis, the Bach, says like this. Ulefi aniusati, in my humble opinion, whenever an authority says in my humble opinion, they're going to either be very radical or wildly attack someone else. In this case, it's going to wildly attack Rav Yosef Karo. Even according to the leading views that Rav Yosef Karo relied on, even according to that, waiving your honor is not an effective strategy. It doesn't work halachically, he says. Why? Right? The meaning of kvod tzibur is not that it's offensive to us, the community. Because if that were the case, right? If what kvod tzibur meant was it's insulting to us, but of course we can waive our honor. But that's not what kvod tzibur means, says the Bach. Ella, rather, perusho, she'ein ze kvod tzibur, she'yishluchu lefanav yisalev, mi she'ein lo hadras panem lahalis al tzibur. What does it mean? It's not that it's offensive to us to have a 16-year-old lead davening for us. It's offensive to God that we should put a 16-year-old before God to be our representative, right? There's a reason why you have to be 30 to be in the Senate, 35 to be president, right? It's not simply about intellectual capacity. It's about respectability, right? The older you are, the more respect you earn. And to be a valid representative, you have to have a certain amount of hadras panim, of seriousness. Ela, davar pashut. Kevan shekach tignu chachamim, once the sages decree that something is not okay because of kvod tzibur, well, there is no power in the community's hands to wave that away. But two, and furthermore, imken kol hanetakanu shetiknu chachamim mekvod tzibur shelo livo sefer Torah betzibur v'chen isha lo tikra betzibur mekvod tzibur im ata omer derashayet. So all these decrees that they decreed that you can't do because of quoted tzibur. You can't roll a Torah scroll because of quoted tzibur. You may not have a woman read Torah. Because remember, they're not talking about that. They're talking about young adult men leading davening. But all these other things, they would cease to be meaningful decrees. Right? If I say, you may not do this thing because it's offensive to you, but you can choose to waive your honor. Well, then that law has no punch, right? If you can waive your honor, then you're always going to waive it when you want to, right? That's a law with no meaning, with no enforceability. But two, and furthermore, dinasu Yisrael agudos. And furthermore, if one community will waive their honor, another community won't, well, they're going to have different practices across the Jewish community, and that's also not okay. So the Bach gives us three different reasons why you can't waive your honor. First of all, it's not about your honor, it's about God's honor. Second of all, to say that it needs the other thing would mean to basically make these laws without any punch, and it will lead to a variety of practices. Now, I will tell you, first of all, I should say, if you follow the Bach, then you can't waive your honor. And therefore, partnership minyanim and egalitarian minyanim that are relying on this notion, I'm not saying that they all are, but if they are, if they're relying on this notion of waiving your honor, well, that's not okay. In order to say that, you have to follow Rav Yosef Karo and reject the Bach. I actually think the Bach is a stronger reading of what's going on here, right? It is in fact the case that it doesn't really make sense to say the sages say you can't do that because of your honor. If you choose to waive your honor, go right ahead and say that, right? But I don't think that means that in fact what it Sibor means we can no longer have mixed gender Torah readings because two things. First, we'll see source number 20 from Rabbi Mendel Shapiro, and then source number 21. So Rabbi Mendel Shapiro, who is a Jerusalem lawyer and rabbi, who wrote this article in, I believe, 15 to 20 years ago, I don't remember the year anymore, which was sort of the article that made the phenomenon of partnership in Yanim really get off the ground. He writes that the opinion of, source number 20, the opinion of Bach and his followers is a corollary of the perception that women's participation in Kriyat Torah is disrespectful to God. Just as one would not send a youngster, however talented and eloquent, to plead his case before the local Lord, so the community should not enlist women to fulfill its duty to provide a Torah reading. However, as I've already pointed out, Bach's opinion reflects a cultural attitude that is no longer shared by mainstream Orthodoxy. He means modern Orthodoxy, because it's not for Haredi Orthodoxy. And most Orthodox Jews would select a competent woman professional or representative without giving the matter second thought. It is, to say the least, ironic that many of those who would rely on Bach to exclude women from Kriyat Torah reject his position with regard to young, fearless Baalei Tefillah. So Rabbi Shapiro is saying the Bach is relying on a view that in fact is objectively offensive to have women read Torah, which in the early modern period when the Bach was writing would have been true, right? If I don't think you're valid enough to be my representative in court, then it is an insult to Torah and to God so that you are valid to be my representative in synagogue. But if I live in a world where I think that, of course, irrespective of gender, I would hire the best lawyer to represent me, well, then there's no violence of footed Sibor have you represent me in synagogue as well. And Rabbi Shai Wald, who in an unpublished tshuva argues for egalitarian prayer, actually makes the point even more strongly in a way that I think reflects more strongly what I believe and what I suspect many of the folks in this room believe. He says like this, the kilos misuyamos in certain congregations, yesh toanim shedavke minyas tafkidim mechubadim menashim, ki habogas bechumat tzibor. In certain congregations, it's the withholding of women from positions of leadership that acts to the violation of quota tzibor. That is to say, if I live in a world where I would vote for folks for Congress, for president, irrespective of gender, I would hire a lawyer irrespective of gender. But in synagogue, there's some arbitrary reason why gender matters. Well, that is actually a mockery of Torah. Because what I'm saying is, in where it really matters, I don't care about gender. But in this sort of ritual realm that I don't take so seriously, it's not offensive because it's just ritual. No, that's actually a violation, right? And therefore, the stronger argument, even according to Bach, I would say, is that, of course, you can't waive your honor. Of course, you can't waive your kvodet sibor. But what constitutes a violation of kvodet sibor is going to be contextual, right? In a world where folks of certain genders are second-class citizens, then it's a violation to have them represent you in synagogue. But if you live in a world, as I do, and as I imagine all of you do, where, in fact, in our world at large, we don't treat gender as dispositive of who is respectable and who is not, then it's actually an insult to Torah and the community that say, well, in the world, in the synagogue, we're going to limit that to folks of one gender.
I would just, it's not on the last part, but just earlier when we were talking about like what would constitute like an ad hoc at home minion. And I was thinking, unfortunately, in the last 6 months, twice in my house, we've had to have a Shiva minion. Thank you. And so that's, I think that would be, you know, very much in that category of, you know, a thrown together in the house minion. It's different people coming every day, whoever's around. And but I guess we had to have a conventional 10 men minion, first of all, just so we could say Kaddish. And, you know, in my community, that's just not going to happen without that. But I think also, I mean, I was thinking, you know, I mean, I was saying Kaddish and I was, you know, participating in everything. But I was, you know, we didn't have a mechitza, but we had men and women sort of sitting, standing separately. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is, you know, I was thinking I have to do this because how am I going to get people to come to my house and make the minyan and fulfill what they think is their obligation for their minyan before they go to work or whatever, if they don't think they're going to get what they personally are comfortable with. So whatever my feelings are, I had to do that, but
yeah. Great. I'll say two things about that. One, that question of practical, trying to figure out something that works for the community. I think that is partially encoded in this question of quoted Seymour. And by the way, we should be honest about what we're saying, right? Do we as a community find this offensive or not? We'll have a great moment next week, actually. We're not going to see it inside, but we'll talk about a sort of a way this might operate in the opposite direction as well. But I also want to emphasize, we're not going to talk about the minyan, right? All this is assuming a minyan that is valid, whatever that means. And what that means, we'll talk about in week 6 and 7. So I think it's Susan, Rachel, Rhonda. I think that's the order which I saw your hands go up.
Hi, thanks. Yes, I mean, this might be discussed further on in the next class, but one thing I was struck by was when I was first introduced to the Shir Hadasha minyan in Jerusalem, the flagship partnership minyan, was that...
flagship, but not the first. But anyway, go on.
Yeah, okay. Rather than reinterpreting Kavod HaTzibur, they substituted Kavod HaBriyot.
Great. So that's another thing. I think it might even be in the first paragraph of the Rabbi Shapiro article that I didn't read out loud. I don't remember, but certainly in his article in general. You will hear people talk about, balancing Kavod HaBriyot, the honor of individuals and the honor of the community, also Kavod HaTorah, honor of Torah. But what I was trying to say, what I think both Rabbi Shapiro and even more strongly Rabbi Wald are trying to say, is that the Kavod HaTzibur is not only that Kavod HaBriyot has to be taken into account, but that Kavod HaTzibur itself, like, what does it mean to say that we're willing to override the community's honor for the sake of individual's honor, right? Who's the community that's being offended by women reading Torah, right? And I think it's easy to sort of, especially when we do it in Hebrew, Kavod HaTzibur, to sort of let that slip and not notice that what we're saying is the idea here is that it's offensive to have women read Torah. Well, I don't think it is offensive, right? And I don't think you do either. I don't know you, Susan, so maybe I shouldn't make that assumption. But I know a synagogue you go to now that you mentioned your rabbis, so I suspect I know what you think. I don't think it's offensive for the Bach to think that it's offensive for women to read Torah, because the Bach lives in a world in which women are second-class citizens. I think that world is offensive, but once you live in that world, to hold the position that the Bach holds, I don't think it's offensive. But I do think it's offensive to hold that view in my world, where women and men and folks of all genders are treated correctly, equally. I think that's a sort of important piece there.
Something I'm noticing, and I think this is probably because I am coming from a space, like I grew up, like you men make the minyan, women don't, is how I grew up. So I'm definitely coming from a place of like wanting to know the sources and also kind of wanting to be convinced. And what I'm noticing is that, like I know intellectually that halacha evolved from us to an extent of like, we have to interpret the text. Every community has to interpret it in their own way in their own time. But like when you grow up Orthodox, you get told like tradition's tradition, right? And this is, it's interesting, like of all the things I've heard of, like to a certain extent, like kosher, for example, I don't know how much latitude we have with kosher. Like those who say they really keep kosher, we all kind of more or less agree on some basics. Yeah. Right. But something like this, I'm like, it seems really clear that, like you said, it's contextual. It's very contextual. It is very difficult to find a text-based source that says this is precisely how you should do it, that we all still match.
Yeah. I mean, for me, what that brings up is I very much buy into this language of tradition is tradition, and it determines what is right, not because it has authority, some artificially determined authority, because I trust these sources to be incredibly and ultimately wise. But what those values, what those principles mean is contextual. And I'll give you an example from Kashrus, Rachel, which is, it is true that I don't imagine a world in which we would say pig is kosher. But if you went to a kosher wedding in the 1950s or even the 1970s, I think, and there was, it was a meat meal and they had non-dairy creamer at the wedding, there would be a big sign saying, this is non-dairy creamer. Every Kashrus organization in America in the 50s for sure, I think in the 70s as well, required signs saying, this is non-dairy creamer, because you don't want people to think that there's dairy and meat at the same meal. Nowadays, if you go to a kosher wedding and they put out dairy creamer, they don't put out a sign saying that. Because we all know in 2023 that non-dairy creamer is a thing. It's very common. And so the principle is the same. We don't want people, not only do we not want people, we don't want you to eat treif, but we also don't want you to think you're eating treif, even if you're eating kosher, right? And in the 1950s, to make sure that you don't think you're eating treif, I need a sign that says, this is non-dairy. But in 2023, I don't need that sign. It's the same rule, don't think you're eating treif, but how it plays out is different depending on the context. Here as well, don't put before the congregation an embarrassing leader, right? I don't want my six-year-old leading davening, even if he's capable. He's not, don't worry. But even if he were, I wouldn't want him leading davening for us, because that would be insulting, right? It would be embarrassing to have a six-year-old lead for a community of adults. But it is not embarrassing to have a woman lead, at least in the communities that I'm a part of. And so the principle remains the same. That tradition remains binding. You may not put forward an embarrassing, unimpressive individual to lead you. But who constitutes an embarrassing and unimpressive individual, that's contextually determined. And that's the only piece that I think changes, right? But the principle does not change at all.
Yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying, because typically in those times, women were not as literate. They were not as knowledgeable. They couldn't have done as good of a job. And it's understandable that in an ad hoc sort of minyan, when there's no alternative and no one had the time to prepare, by that same token, for Kvod HaTzibur, you don't want to have somebody who's struggling, whether they're an adult male or not, today, up there reading Torah, where the, you know, the opposite mm-hmm. of where it's a tircha de tzibura. It's just interesting that a katan, but I assume it was a male katan, leading was not considered a problem for Kvod HaTzibur. That's just interesting to me. But I guess they were better typically.
Well, and I think what we do see, you know, the sources that we saw were actually not even talking about a katan. They're talking about an adult male, but one who's not yet old enough to have a full beard. Right? Imagine a 15-year-old kid. And it is striking that that piece of it is still played around with. And there are differences between a sort of hiring a cantor and having someone just lead mincha one day, right? So leading mincha one day, that's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about hiring a cantor. But the argument is that, you know, I live in Riverdale. There's a community that I know regularly hires teenagers to read the Parsha, right? And that could be a quoted Seabor issue potentially. Maybe not, right? Maybe we live in a day where 16-year-olds are already considered honorable enough for that. But it is striking that outside of the Yemenite community, the practice of actual minors reading Torah and leading Marv on Saturday night, which is a practice that happened in the past and I believe still happens in the Yemenite community, is striking that that has basically been eliminated from the vast majority of Jewish communities.
Yeah, in our shul, we only have a rabbi. We're entirely lay-led otherwise, and we read a full Kriya, and it's all lay-led, but we do have to deal with the Kvod HaTzibur issue of people who are better prepared or better confident. And that gets into all sorts of other interpersonal modern-day issues.
Right. And there are, you know, as Lynn was saying before, there are practical issues to be figured out of, like, got to have the people to read the Torah. But also, it is worth taking seriously. What does Kvod HaTzibur mean in terms of people who don't prepare properly? All right. Thank you, everyone. I will see you, God willing, next week.